tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
Welcome to Dolcezza Sherbet Radio on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Violeta Edelman, and I'm here with my co-host.
I'm Rob Duncan, also Dolcezza.
We are owners of Dolcezza Gelato in Washington, D.C., and we are very excited because this is our first official show here at Full Service Radio, and we have an awesome guest for our first show, Sean Eskenazi. Sean is the founder and CEO of Eskenazi Chocolate, an award-winning small batch chocolate company known for sourcing 100% of its cocoa beans directly from farmers across the globe. And this is a huge deal. We're going to talk about this later, but this is very unique for small companies and bigger companies. So Sean wrote a wonderful book titled Meaningful Work, and he's here with us to talk about how we find meaning in our work and in our lives, among other things. Welcome, Sean, and thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
I want to start talking about how the book came along. You were a criminal defense lawyer for 20 years. You got to a point in which you were exhausted and drained by this profession, and you went on a quest trying to find meaning, and you ended up in a Trappist monastery. And I just want to tell you that Rob and I went through a similar process. He was a software engineer. I was a documentarian. And we went on a search, and we ended up in the Amazon, and we ended up making gelato. You ended up making chocolate. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of parallels in the stories. And the one difference is that, you know, you were in a monastery. We were in nature. Some people are in caves in
what's
the Himalayas.
The
exactly. Yeah. So what's
shamans,
the difference?
Monks.
Yeah, that's my point. It's like the true meaning of, you know, religion to me is it transcends any particulars, right? And you can find answers in many ways. But for you, and what I find fascinating is that somebody whose last name is Eskenazi, but is an Episcopalian convert and is in a Catholic monastery of all places. So tell me your story and tell me what answers did you find in the monastery?
Well, first, thanks for having me. This is really exciting, and I'm glad to be your first guest. That's quite an honor. Well, for me, my father was raised as a Jew in New York City, and his father was raised in Argentina and born in Russia and basically kicked out of Russia. And so my father is the one who converted, which was to my grandparents' displeasure, but he converted to Christianity when he was in the Marine Corps. And so my mom was a Southern Baptist, my dad was raised a Jew, and so I was an Episcopalian, of course, that makes sense. But I, you know, for me, it was one of those things where my reputation was really built on the defense of murder cases, and I never lost a criminal jury trial in 20 years. And that's the kind of job that when you stop feeling the passion for it, you can't phone it in. It would be like a 747 pilot. Literally, when you have people's lives in your hands, you can't half-ass it. And so when I felt the inspiration and passion for that work draining from me, I could feel it physically, emotionally, spiritually. And I knew it was my passion for 20 years, and then it wasn't. And the problem that I faced was, what's next? How do I find passion? How do I find inspiration? And that was the beginning of my quest.
Okay, so how do you end up in the monastery?
The way I ended up in the monastery was that my father died when I was 14 years old. He died of lung cancer, and he was a lawyer like me and my hero. And at the time, the church that we were going to, an Episcopal church, was this charismatic Episcopal church. They all spoke in tongues, and they would come over and lay hands on my father and say that he would be healed, and they yelled. And it was kind of scary for a young person, But they told me to never speak about death with my father. They said, if I speak of death with him, that it'll be a sign of doubt and that he wouldn't be healed. So every time my dad tried to say something about it, I pushed him away and said, don't say that, you won't be healed. And then I was with him when he died, and it was the most desperate, sorrow-filled moment of my life. I begged God not to let him die, and anyway, he did. But as it turns out, the last night of my father's life was at that monastery. He was on a church retreat with his friends. So fast forward 25 years, I finished a murder case and was really exhausted. And I thought, you know, I think I'm going to go to that monastery where my dad spent his last night. Hmm. That's how I got there.
How old were you when your father died?
14.
Wow.
That's pretty deep stuff. I mean, we're going straight to, like, last time we talked to you, you know, straight to suffering and death.
Yeah, well, and I would add, I've been going to that monastery for 17 years now.
What I want to say is that for Rob and I, you know, suffering and death are teachers. You know, people are scared of suffering and death. They were telling you not to talk about death with your father, but I think that they're utterly necessary experiences to let go of the ego. And I think that, you know, that they make you appreciate important things in life, and being brought down to your knees is really, you know, what takes you to that meaningful place that you talk about in your book. So I do feel like, you know, there's all these forces that, you know, in our world that makes us consume and makes us think that, you know, and you talk about this again in your book. It's a big theme of your book, consumerism and commercialism, and makes us think that's the right thing to do and that is going to make us happy. So I found incredibly profound some of the things that you say, you know, and you talk about meaningful consumption. So tell us a little bit about what do you mean by that?
One of the things that, and I should add, my daughter Lauren is my co-author, and she's an amazing writer, and this was a 3-year project, and it was awesome just to be able to work with her on the book, and she really helped me articulate some of these points, one of which is what you're speaking of now. Chapter 3 of the book is titled, How Much is Enough? And what I'm trying to do is set up this idea that really was, in the modern age, was brought to us by George W. Bush after 9/11, when he said, if you want to help America, go shop. Now, we see literally websites that track how many people are stampeded and trampled to death on Black Friday. And we have to get ourselves out of this frog in the boiling pot of water and recognize what's happening, and that is we're measuring the health of our families, our economy, our country on consumption. We think that GDP is everything. And so what I'm asking is for people to just step back and ask whether, in fact, that is the truth. Is that the true measure of the health of our business, of our economy, of our country? And can we measure something else as, quote, enough? And I say in the book, and I would say this applies to you guys as well, look, you're selling the highest quality dessert that you can get on earth, and I am too. It's the best of the best. So am I saying I don't want people to consume that? No. I want people to buy $10 chocolate bars. What I'm asking, though, is for people to think about it. I'm asking for them to be mindful about it. I mean, you don't want somebody coming in buying the same gelato 3 times a day, 365 days a year, and I don't want that either. So that's the kind, and really the genesis of the ideas of this chapter come from the monastery. Monasteries all over the world are governed by the rule of Benedict. They have been for 1500 years. And in that rule, it says to monasteries, those that brew beer in Europe, those that make fruitcakes in the United States, make enough beer that is sufficient. That's the word they use. Is it sufficient to be able to run this monastery? And yet my chocolate factory is not a monastery. No, but I want to pull some threads from that idea and say to myself and to my company, how much is enough?
And the circles that you swim in as far as the food makers, the farmers, etc., do you see that in those smaller circles, kind of that same mentality, shared space? Because the message from Alt High is totally the opposite of what you're saying right now.
I see it. And the most recent example I can think of is when I was in Tanzania this past summer, visiting with the co-op that I've been buying beans from for years, which is led by a woman, I should add, Mama and Pokey. And I asked her how many members were in the cooperative, and she said, only 60. And I said, well, are you trying to get more members? No, we're not. Well, why not? Because 60 is enough. And she said, we know that with 60, that's the group that we can trust. We're not trying to get more. We just want the people there that are our friends and the people that we know and that we can trust, so we can trust each other and make good cocoa beans. That's the most recent best example I can think of.
Right. Mm-hmm. Rob and I have three small girls, so you know, this is something that we try to teach our kids every day. And it gets harder and harder with things like Amazon, right? That you press a button and you get a box instantly in your house, right? So the lack of process, right? That there is this result that appears out of nowhere. And so there are several quotes in your book that I really, really like. And there's one that says, what saves a man is to take a step and then another step. And this is by Saint-Exupéry, the author of Little Prince, my all-time favorite book when I was growing up. I bought one for Rob. He hasn't read it yet. This is a total scene, but he has to. So what I want to talk about is, you know, the concept of process, which I think is extremely important also to small businesses, to your book, to life, right? Not focusing on the result, but what it takes to get there. Can you talk to a little bit about that?
Sure. The process, even though I've been in Washington this week, I've been talking to my people in my factory every day this week, because I would say the thing that is utmost of my mind is not how much chocolate can we make, but how much chocolate can we make and have an orderly process. The orderly flow is more important to me than anything. And what I mean by that is that I don't want a space that is chaotic. I don't want people to run from one, literally run from one thing to the next thing. I don't want them to be breathing from their shoulders up. I want them to be breathing from their abdomen. I mean that literally, and I also mean it figuratively. And so we want to create a process. And believe, I've been doing this for almost 12 years, and I'm still in the process of creating the process, because I always want to tweak these notions of how is it that my space can be peaceful. It's more important to me to have a peaceful workspace than a workspace that produces tons of chocolate.
Yeah, well said. You know, the one thing about process that I have seen more and more, especially with having little kids, is it seems like now, just recently within the last decade, that it seems process is disappearing. And I equate that to kind of the old world being the analog wave, to where now we're more in a digital world where it's a discrete zero and one. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like the old days of Lou Reed jamming in his garage with his friends for 20 years and not really giving a fuck about going big or viral or famous, that was not any intent in there. It was all about getting together and jamming, you know, and that was the process that right. Then eventually led them to become well-known, famous, etc. That seems to be something that's disappearing now, because it's like everybody has the end game in mind whenever they do whatever it is that they do. Do you see the same thing?
I do. I mean, it's because we all get our dopamine hits from Instagram and Facebook now.
Yeah.
That's where it comes from. And yes, I want our company to have Instagram followers, but I worry about that this generation that we're in that is leaving this idea that you just articulated, I think, really beautifully. And what I see is when it comes to artificial intelligence, and then when it comes to robotics, and when it comes to process, and I know you guys are going to understand what I'm talking about, with all of these things, I don't worry about it, because I feel like I am part of the counter trend, and I want to be part of the counter trend. And the counter trend is manifested in all kinds of ways. It can be, as you said in the beginning of the show, it can be being in nature. It can be being a witness to creation unfolding every day before us. It can be in community with people, and we find new ways to form communities that are participating in this counter trend in all sorts of a variety of ways. And that's what this book is about. I am part of a larger counter trend, And I'm at peace about it and actually joyful about being part of this. And it's exciting, I think.
Yeah. Wow, John, that's deep stuff and super inspiring. We're going to take a short break. We're here at Dolcezza Sherbet Radio on Full Service Radio. We'll be back very soon.
Full Service Radio is supported by Compass. Discover Compass, America's first modern real estate company. By pairing the industry's top agents with technology, Compass delivers an incomparable client experience from the first-time buyer to the seasoned seller. Visit them today in DC, Maryland, and Virginia, or navigate compass.com day or night. And the break music you're listening to right now, it's called Iceland by Flash Frequency, local producer, and also host of Leaf Broadcast Thursdays at 6. We'll be right back on Dolcezza Sherbet Radio.
Welcome back to the Dolcezza Sherbet Radio on Full Service Radio. We are here with Sean Eskenazi, founder and CEO of Eskenazi Chocolate. And we are talking about his book, Meaningful Work. The premise of your book is that by focusing on other people and on being versus doing, eventually you discover your true self. So I want to dig into these concepts. I want us to explain to us, what do you mean by being versus doing, and what exactly is your true self?
The being versus doing is, the reason I know so much about it is because I can't do it. And I have had a life struggle with this practice, but only in the last maybe 5 or 6 years have I become aware of the fact that I can't do it. So I'm making progress, and that is... One of my two spiritual directors at Assumption Abbey, where I'm a family brother now. So I used to go there as a guest. Now I'm a family brother, and I live with the monks when I'm there. I follow their schedule, wake up at 3:15 in the morning and chant the psalms with them and work with them and pray with them. But my spiritual director said that I needed to find a place in my life where I could find myself in a place of being inserted by doing, as opposed to doing inserted by being. So in other words, the core of my life is doing, but where I want to be is the core of my life as being inserted by doing. And so that is it's a path, it's a push and pull and push and pull. And what I mean by that is, and I think all of us hard charging type A entrepreneurs can understand this idea of action, execution, implementation, doing, accomplishing. And I believe that when I'm doing and I'm accomplishing and I'm executing and I'm implementing, that I'm somehow becoming a better person, or that I'm accomplishing what I want to accomplish. But in fact, it is really the other way around. When I can reach a place of being, at rest, really, and in my faith, resting in God's presence as a place of being, and then I let those other things orbit around that central core, doing, you know, taking action, that's the place where I want to be. And it's been a real challenge for me, but I'm glad to know that it's been a challenge, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners will find connection to that idea, because it's really hard, and it's really hard right now. And the reason it's hard now is because we're inundated with distraction. constantly.
So, you know, you talk about being in that state of being as opposed to doing. What are your ways of getting there? Because I think that's something that's really interesting to Violeta myself, as far as the techniques of ecstasy, the techniques of getting there and yeah. then holding yourself there when you then start on the doing.
Yes. Or being in the present moment.
Well, not I think even that's not the even same thing,
ecstasy, right?
Right? Being is in the present moment. That's
and
probably
is that where your true self is?
Yes. Yes, your true self is your. Thank you, and thank you for putting it that way. Your true self is in the present moment. It is in the state of being in the present moment, and the present moment is full of who God created you to be. It is your soul unmasked, unburdened by your ego. And so what I want to try to do is have glimpses of my true self. And then I want to remember that. I want to remember what home, my true self, looks like, so that I can point myself in that direction. And to Rob's question, you know, there are many techniques, but we have to remember that we don't focus on the technique or we lose the glory of the end. And Bruce Lee talked about that. We don't want to focus on the finger pointing to the moon, he said. Otherwise we'll lose the glory of the moon. Or words to that effect.
Right.
And so techniques are important. But for me, for example, I have a morning routine right after I wake up that would include some centering prayer, praying for other people. I spend time praying for people who are sick that I know of or who have children that are sick. And then I have, you know, a stretching routine. I have a candle and I'm following the Catholic lectionary, reading the Bible. Then I have a little bell on my phone that rings 5 times a day at the time of the daily office for Catholics. And that little ding will just point me, just points me to just for that second to maybe not be an asshole just for a minute or maybe even less than a minute. And then I have a mantra, you know, that I say, my mind right now is I surrender. I surrender. And that those are some things. And then I have some things that I do in the evening. And then I have things that I do, for example, one of the things that I've been experimenting with in the last 2 years is something called yoga nidra, which is yogic sleep. And there it's
we're
not
familiar.
Yeah. And it's not a simple thing and it requires some practice, but that's something that I'm trying to put myself
because
in.
Because you're trying to add awareness to the process of sleeping, right?
Yes, but what I'm trying to do is, you know, you lay in Shavasana and you're so it's not yoga, I mean, except for the fact that it's Shavasana. And what you're doing is essentially putting your conscious in theta state, and which is deeper than sleep. And in that space is where these things come in and where we also can recognize our true self.
Do you find that a lot of the unconscious or the subconscious comes into, you know, your dreams that way? And is that a way of learning from what we're not aware of in our own minds?
I believe that. And I, you know, I'm a follower of my own dreams, literally. I mean, and I'm often journaling those. So sure, I believe that's true. But one of the things I wanted to mention before I forget that Rob said is one of my spiritual directors said that the idea for me is that when I'm not at the monastery, that I take it with me and that I keep it in my heart. And so that's the idea, I think, for any of these practices, whatever your religion or faith practice may be, that while we're not in the practice, that we have a memory of it. And that it's, as I said, it's a home for us and that we can keep it with us even when we're not practicing.
100%. It's, you know, when you get down to any of the world religions, philosophies and practices, you realize that all of them have the same cores, because meditation, yoga, that's the end game as far as like, you know, you do it so much. So then you then go through life in that state, in that meditative state,
right.
In the yogic state, etc. A question for you. Do you try to incorporate any of this or teach any of this to the folks in your business?
I do, but it's in a very gentle, I don't ever force anybody into these things. And I try to very gently, very kindly offer some of these things, but not, and it's a very slow process, but yes.
So you mentioned that you're an active member in the Trappist Monastery, and I know you go on spiritual retreats. And
A brother
from another mother.
That's right.
And you talk about this in your book, the importance of going on retreat and plugging and solitude, which is another topic that Rob and I obsess over. We have a lot of parallels with you because we talk about all the time about the importance of disconnecting from the rat race in order to connect to yourself. So tell us more about why this is important to you.
Well, I think some people are attracted to solitude, and I'm one of them and have been now for many years. And I think sometimes people are confused when I say retreat, and I've had many people in the last couple of months ask me about, does it have to be a silent retreat, or do I have to do these certain things?
People tend to get very specific.
They do. And what I try to tell them is just lighten up. It's not that big of a deal. It's what you want it to be. I've been on retreat at the monastery where I've talked the whole time. I've been on retreat where I've said nothing. What I think it's important for people to understand is to tiptoe into this pool how they see fit. And I try to outline in the book, some things that people might want to think about, and when it comes to retreat, what to take with them. To not have an agenda. I think it's really important on retreat to not this is my things to do list, and this is I'm going to answer all of these big questions in my life.
That's so American,
That is such a uniquely
American quality
exactly.
of the
it
person.
Is. Because yeah. As I said, it's again another state of doing and not being. And so
it defeats the purpose.
It does defeat the purpose. It's for relaxation, it's for rest, I have found, to my disappointment, it's not really for answers.
It's for being versus doing.
Well, yes. It's so funny. I probably you've all heard this, but I remember when I saw the first time that thing that says, don't just, what is it? Don't just sit there, do something. Don't just do something, sit there.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
Good.
It's like such a thing. It's like everything is measured on our accomplishments.
Yeah.
And it's on the exterior, it seems like, as opposed to the interior state of well-being. There's not very much, if any, importance in the mainstream culture. Obviously, you have little subcultures and groups of people and all that, and some have more emphasis and importance on that than others. But in the broadcast message beamed out for what we should spend our lives doing, there's very little importance on that, state of happiness,
And I also think, too, that some of these things that we're talking about, they tie together, right? I mean, so the retreat ties together with these techniques that we were talking about, meditation, yoga nidra. The thread is, and religion. So in my view, religion is man's response to God. And so I desire mystical experiences. I want to have mystical experiences because it's a place for me to encounter the divine. And while we don't want answers, what I want is I want to put my hands up. I want to surrender to the mystical experience and the encounter with the divine. It could be on retreat. It could be in meditation. It could be meeting you guys. And the idea is the more we practice this, then the more our hearts are open to it when we least expect it.
Exactly. It's like one of those things where you really can't just do it on the natch, right? But the more that you practice it, the more susceptible you are to actually it happening.
That's right.
So that's the importance of practice.
Yep.
Sean, I want to talk a little bit about chocolate, right?
What does this have to do with chocolate and gelato?
Yeah, who the F cares? I introduce you by saying that your company sources 100% of its cocoa beans directly from farmers across the world. And I said that we were going to go back to that because guys, this is a huge deal. I mean, Askinos is the only company in this country, maybe in the world, doing this.
And Sean, for this Askinosy chocolate was probably the first or one of the first of the bean to bar chocolates. Now mm-hmm. that the craft chocolate movement is hot,
exploding,
blowing up, this guy right here, Sean, started this whole thing here in this country.
Yes.
I mean, on this planet, you know that, and
yeah.
and there is a lot of importance to that as far as. You know, Sean can explain why the importance of the farmer and you walk the walk to actually go to the farmer, sit down with the P&L and share that information with him to share the profits. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something that most people, even on the inside of the local movement, don't do that. Go to that extent, that degree to do that.
I was there last week in the Philippines.
Yeah.
Yep. Doing just that. Profit sharing with farmers, showing them our financials. Yeah.
That's incredible.
So this is called direct trade, right? And this is something that, you know, first there was fur trade, and then there was direct trade. And you mentioned in your book that you look at a lot of the coffee companies and the third wave coffee companies. And we did too, Rob and I, that they were pioneers in this. And you mentioned Intelligentsia Coffee. So what did you learn from the coffee companies and how did you create this model of direct trade and sourcing directly from the farmers and eventually doing something even, like Rob said, more revolutionary, which is sitting with the P&L, translating it to their language and sharing profits?
Jeff Watts for Intelligentsia Coffee is really the pioneer of direct trade. And he was an early mentor of mine. And so I used their model loosely with his advice on how to create this. And essentially it involved contracts, we call them transparency agreements. So, and unlike coffee, there's basically no supply chain. So I pay the farmers directly. The woman that you see on the front of that package there, we put that in her bank account for her small cooperative. In some cases, like in Tanzania, I help them open bank accounts. And the thing is with direct trade is it's not a regulated phrase like fair trade. Direct trade is what we say it is or what Intelligentsia says it is. But the key is, if you're a consumer, is the company doing what they say they're doing, and do you trust them? And so I've been doing this for over a decade, and what we've most recently done, and this took a long time to put together, but we put on our website a few months ago, we listed every single bean purchase we've ever made in 11 years, what we paid the farmers, who the farmers were, what the price was at farm gate compared to what we paid them, how much we profit shared with them, what the world market price was at the time, and what the fair trade price was. And that took a long time to put together, and now we're keeping it up to date because we want our customers and you guys as our customers to be able to see it and know that in 11 years, we have paid farmers 48% more on average than they would have otherwise received at farm gate, which is the apples to apples comparison. And we have pre-financed these cocoa beans in 64% of the transactions. That is paying them way in advance with money that I really could use now, you know, because we finance everything out of our cash flow. We don't have lines of credit. And so, you know, the thing is with these farmers is like when I'm in Tanzania, we translate our financials into Swahili so that they can understand how we profit share with them. And then we can talk about the farmers more, but I went on too long.
That's awesome, man, to hear that story. And, you know, the whole time as you're talking about that and going to those pains and that extent, because you're doing it, you're going there and actually sitting down with the farmer, it's just... You know, and you've been around for 11 years, Askinosy mm-hmm. Chocolate. We've been around, this July will be 14 years and doing it, and you've grown, we've grown. And it's so fascinating. And then other companies like Intelligentsia, like Stumptown, which now are owned by the same mm-hmm. holding company, both. It's that thing that I the trajectory of a business, you know. It seems you so many stories are this way, where you have Jeff Watts, Dwayne, those people going to the farmer and coining direct trade, and so you pay 50% more than what fair trade would have paid them, etc. And then what happens, though, you grow to a certain level, you get on the radar of the larger companies, those larger companies come and put so much money on the table.
Really?
That it's hard to walk
Where
away.
Where is it?
Not for me, not Somebody for you, but that's the rumor out there. But then what happens is that way of doing stuff is kind of broken apart, bottom lined, and then assimilated by the larger corporation. And it seems like it's just, I always ask myself, is there, are there other ways? Are there other models? What is the other model?
Enough is enough. Don't you have a whole chapter on what is enough?
I do.
Right.
But I think you raise a good point. And look, I mean, I am continually amazed at the entrepreneurs who say, oh, I would never, I'm not ever going to sell my company. I mean, let's be honest. If some guy walked in here and said, I'll give you $10 million for your company, I'd be like, oh, okay. Peace. I mean, I would be like, see you guys later. But the point, here's the deal. This company was an answer to prayer for me. I mean, we haven't really talked about that yet, but I mean, it was, you know, and it was born out of my desperate search for a new passion. And so I'm not on the radar of those big companies because our revenues are not high enough to be on the radar. But one of the things that, and look, this is a struggle. I've been doing this for 11 years. We're profitable. We share profits. I pay a living wage to the people that work for me, but it's hard. It's hard. I mean, managing cash flow is hard to do. And so here's, and I hope my wife isn't listening because she will not like what I'm about to say. And that is the struggle, the difficulty and the challenge, I think is kind of where God wants me to be. God wants me to be nestled under his or her wing, right there. And I think sometimes if I was on the radar of those big, huge companies who want to pay me $10 million, that I might think that I can do things by myself, that I don't need God and that I'm independent of God. And I'm not saying that as a defeatist. I'm saying it because it's where I want to be. I want to be close. I want to need that. I want to need people.
That's so awesome you say that, because it's this, you know, there's so many parallels in your life, in your business, in our lives, in our business. And we this winter, we've opened up a couple of shops and we've invested a lot of our own cash flow and money into the business for growth, for opening stores. And so this winter for us has been a dark winter, a cold winter, you know, and it's put us much more closer to the day in, the day out, what's important, the bedrock of it, not the fluff at all, not the fluff of, wow, you guys are doing great, you're growing and this and that. And we've said that. It's like there's something about this suffering that we like. Because it doesn't feel good. It feels like shit.
Yeah.
It feels terrible when you don't, when I, 3 o'clock in the morning, I sit down with Bialetta and, you know, we're talking about bills and this and that. But there's something about it. What it is it holds you to what's truly important. And it doesn't allow you to get up there and talk and think about and dwell on the stuff that's not really important. You know,
yeah,
and
like that, how that's, great that's, we are.
Right. Exactly. So it's like, it's so funny you say that, because this is the same conversation. Almost 14 years into it, you know, and it's like, no matter, it's so funny, the perception of small business, I think, from the outside.
Right.
People see probably from the outside, and it's like, wow, they're just rolling, they're banking.
Oh, yeah.
But the struggles and the vulnerabilities of a small business never end. 13 years, 14, 11, 5, it's interesting.
And that's what I'm trying to say, and that's what I say. I have a whole chapter in the book on scale, which I call reverse scale. Everybody thinks, oh, we're going to get there someday. There's a plan where we can breathe easy and live and learn when we grow to this point. Well, the problem is we never get to that point. So we really need to, I think, be mindful
Kill
of this
the
idea.
Fucking carrot.
Yeah, that's right.
Get rid of it.
That's right.
Yeah. It goes back to what you just said, being.
Exactly.
So you're not out there chasing that idea, which always changes.
Right.
Yeah.
Sean, you know this because we talked about this in the past, but Rob and I are extremely aligned with your values, you know, developing compassion, giving, learning from all these, you know, learning from suffering, finding meaning, you know, through this maze and just, you know, this have been themes that define our lives and us as human beings. And I have never encountered a book that mixes both worlds, the spiritual world and the business world, which sometimes can seem at odds, so well as your book does. So I want to congratulate you on that, on that achievement, and I want to thank you so much for talking to us today.
Sean, this is like the best way to kick off this Sherbert Radio here with you and your story and your chocolate. So thank you for everything.
I'm pleased to be here and really appreciated our conversation.
Yeah, mutual.
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to Dolcezza Sherbert Radio. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.